This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Jamie Moore pitched his first game in 1986 when Ronald Reagan was president and many of today's players hadn't been born yet. In 2012, he became the oldest pitcher in Major League history to win a game. What explains his longevity in a sport with a lot of wear and tear and injuries, especially for pitchers? Part of the answer is a sports psychologist named Harvey Dorfman, whose practical advice and aggressive manner helped Moyer through a bad patch early in his career. Jamie Moore played with a lot of teams during those years, including the Phillies, and was part of the team that won the World Series in 2008. He and Larry Platt have co-authored a new book called Just Tell Me I Can't about his years on the mound and what he learned from Dorfman, a foul-mouthed psychologist, about mental focus and toughness. And they both join us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Jamie Moore, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having us on today.
Everyone is all excited in this building. And Larry Platt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Jamie, I was reading actually an article by Stan Hockman in the Philadelphia Daily News saying that you're considering a return to Major League Baseball, and we're all supposed to look at your fingertips to see if you've got long nails and getting ready for a knuckleball. I'm looking.
They're not real long, and I'm not getting ready for a knuckleball. And actually, I just did an interview earlier, and they said, usually when you come out with a book, that means that you're no longer going to be playing. And I said, that's probably true.
Oh, probably. Is probably the operative word, though?
Most definitely. Put it that way.
And I saw a press conference you did in Seattle in April saying that you haven't closed the door yet. And I realize it's hard to think about retirement.
Yeah, and I don't like to use that R word, you know. And in baseball, you know, I think the way I look at this is, you know, I came into this game kind of invisible, and I'd kind of like to leave the game as an invisible person. You know, I'm not bigger than the game. The game will always be that. I will always respect that. And I just think it's the healthy way to do things.
But you've written a book, so now everyone's asking you this question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's okay. That's all good.
So why did you want to write a book with Jamie Moore, Larry?
Well, your introduction got to it. It was basically the mystery of how does this guy do it? He was not only the oldest pitcher to win a game, but arguably the best old pitcher ever. You know, you look at Tom Seaver. Between the ages of 38 and 42, he was 66 and 64. Jamie Moyer was 74 and 33. You know, it is a singular accomplishment, especially for a guy who only threw 80 miles per hour. So how did he do it? And when we first started talking about it, I realized that it was because he figured out, as he says, that baseball takes place from the neck up. And so we want to delve into the mystery of the mental side of the game.
Well, and which got you to this guy named Harvey Dorfman.
Yes.
You this was in your late 20s, right?
It was in my late 20s. Right. I had read one of his books, The Mental Guide to Baseball or Mental Game of Baseball. And I've really kind of felt like I understood the book and I was going to take this information and run with it. And you know, I think as a little time elapsed, I realized that I didn't really completely understand it as well as I thought. And my agent at the time had the good fortune of turning me on to to Harvey in the off season. And I went to go visit him in Prescott, Arizona, and spent 2.5 days with him. And really then came to realize that, well, I didn't realize this information as well as I read it. And the time spent with Harvey was very, very productive, I guess I could say. And actually, I think it was kind of the beginning of the end of, or not the end of my career, but kind of my second career.
In fact, you played better in your 40s than you did in your 20s.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, I think maturity and age had something to do with that, but experience. Mm-hmm. And also some of the clubs I played on were, you look at this Philadelphia team in the 2000s that I played on was a pretty special group of guys.
So what did he teach you? I mean, talking about the sort of mental game of baseball.
Yeah, it taught me, a lot about, dedication. Each time you do something, there's a task at hand, and to focus on that task. He taught me that, we all have fears in life. And we all, and a lot of times we have anxiety towards that fear, and it's a negative anxiety, or it takes you down a horrible path because of the fears that you have. Let's take that energy that we're wasting and using on those fears and try to figure out a way to get through that and turn it into a positive. And all of a sudden that fear, all of a sudden isn't as big as it used to be. And now you can get over that hurdle. And, it may be a fear of failure. It may be a fear of losing. And, in some baseball analogies or in school, it might be fear of failing a test or not being prepared. Well, how are we going to figure out how to get around that and get past that?
Well, it seemed like he also was saying to you that your lack of speed, if I can say
that,
was a weapon.
Exactly.
It wasn't a weakness
and,
for
exactly.
you.
Exactly. And taking that and becoming aggressive, using aggression with that, but a controlled aggression. And all that comes from learning about yourself and learning what you have, for baseball, we can call it tools or weapons. You can say a baseball is a weapon, but it's using the tool from your shoulders up and how to start to categorize things and what is important and what's not important and learning that what other people think or say it maybe isn't the most important thing, but how you feel and what you think and how you're working towards that goal or that direction, that's what's really important. And if you do it well, what those people think and say is going to be really good.
I do want to pick up on that, but let me turn to you, Larry. I said this to you before we went on the air. You describe Harvey Dorfman as having a non-NPR voice. Right. So not the sort of mellifluous NPR sound.
Yes, not the gentleness of Marty Moscoane. He was an in-your-face, macho persona, which an athlete responds to. Had it been this soothing, comforting... So one of the first things Harvey said to Jamie is, "I've seen your act, kid. You got to get better." Uh-huh. I mean, that is in your face.
He didn't sugarcoat anything.
And you really put your finger on it, Marty. The thing that, for the past 2.5 years, Jamie has been my tutor in sort of getting a PhD in pitching. And it took me a long time to wrap my head around the fact that it's actually an act of aggression to throw 67 mile an hour curveball. You think of aggression, and this is what Harvey was talking about. You think of it as like 95 mile an hour fastball. His aggression is making guys look foolish because they can't hit this slow pitch. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Well, and what's interesting about Harvey, and there are many things interesting about Harvey Dorfman, who did die, I guess, a year or so ago.
About three years ago. Unfortunately, yes.
But it seems like he, Larry, knew fear himself. He wasn't a player. He was a sickly kid.
Right.
So he knew something about fear.
He battled fear. He was asthmatic from birth and grew up in the Bronx. And, I mean, fascinating parallels between these two lives as I did my research. His father, like Jamie's father, was a mentor who used baseball to teach life lessons. And Harvey knew fear, and he had developed – he wasn't a trained psychiatrist or psychologist. He developed his own – long before a lot of people have come to this, he developed his own regimen for overcoming fear and gaining success.
And when you went to him, what were you afraid of?
Probably some of it was failure or, getting released or not having a job. Because baseball was something, as a little boy, I wanted to do, just like many other little boys, have that dream. But, I just, as I became a young man, I still believe that. And why wouldn't I? Because I had a lot of success, and I was doing something that I enjoyed doing. But as I got to the professional level, obviously I was now playing with and against guys that were as good and in most cases had way more talent than I had. And I, then started to learn that, talent will get you only so far. But, how you use that talent and how you use the talent of, your brain, and that what was really kind of fascinating as things started to evolve for me. And then it became intriguing, and the more I get into it, the more I wanted to work with it, and realized that it's some very simple changes that I had to make, but I had to have an awareness towards those changes.
Was it also changing the conversation you might be having with yourself?
Most definitely.
And I think anyone that is feeling like they're not working up to their speed, then you begin to beat yourself up.
Exactly. And it's the negativity. And when you're saying that conversation, it's usually a negative conversation, and a lot of times that's based off of negative results. Or the negative results are based off of the conversation that you're having with yourself because you're not allowing yourself to put yourself into a positive situation and have positive thoughts. And usually when we have negative outcomes, then if you look back at things, there's negative thoughts that go with that. And that's where, you know, and I can look back at my career and look at teams that I've been on, and you look at the negative outcome as a team, it was a huge reflection on how we were as a group.
Interesting.
And the negativity. And then you look at the teams that won, you look at, you know, the positive side and the way they approach things. So you can see how that can really play a huge role, you know, on an individual basis, but as a team and even as a fan base. Really?
Hey, you're here in Philadelphia. But were you playing with the sort of head of the batter as well? I mean, the idea is that, I mean.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, again, you know, the direction, you know, one of the directions that Harvey taught me was that, you know, we all have an ego. And if you can learn how to play off of people's egos and use their egos against them. And, you know, I kind of liken it to, you know, the bigger the guy, the stronger the guy, the bigger the swing, the harder the swing. That played into what I was as a pitcher, because I was more of an off-speed type of a pitcher. I relied on deception. So I wanted to show you what a fastball looked like, but maybe it wasn't in the strike zone. But now I'm tempting you with that pitch, and now I'm going to throw you something slow that might be in the strike zone and looks like a fastball, and I want you to react to it like a fastball, but it just never got to the plate.
But are we talking about humiliation, Larry, here, humiliating the batter?
It is no accident that he flourished in his 40s, which was the same time as the steroid era. So you had all these players who were all jacked up, who come up to that plate, and they're going to take this cream puff pitcher deep. And he just sent them back on their way to the dugout because he used that. And he would pick up signs from them. He calls it listening to the at-bat. Pick up signs from them in the at-bat. And he'd say, like, to himself, that internal dialogue, he'd say, now I've got him. Because because the guy's, if he's slow to get around on that outside pitch, now I've got him inside. Mm-hmm. He calls it the cat and mouse game. And it's poker. It's poker.
And it's fun, I guess. Right? I mean, especially if things are going
and
well.
It's challenging because you feel like you have to be one step ahead, but it's all right in front of you. And if you're just receptive to it, you use your eyes and use your ears, because sometimes verbally, some things are said verbally, you can hear it. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching body language, or if you're watching a swing, or the body language after a swing, or if the guy makes an out, how he acts or reacts, or then you watch him go out on the field. And now all of a sudden, you've turned his day into a bad day. He's really, the way I look at it, he's turned his own day into a bad day. I just happen to be the conduit to help him do that.
You know,
Hold on to that thought, only just because we have to take a very short break. And talking with Jamie Moyer, all-star pitcher, and Larry Platt, co-author of a new book called Just Tell Me I Can't, How Jamie Moyer Defied the Radar Gun and Defeated Time. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I should say to our listeners, I'm looking on the table here. There's a garter belt, some corks, and some notes. And we will talk about all of that after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Off-Broad Street Theater Consortium supports WHYY and announces the launch of their new mobile app. This app is available now and offers users access and exclusive ticket options to alternative theaters like 11th Hour, Azuka, Brat, Ego Poe, Flashpoint, Inishnua, and Mockingbird. Android and iPhone users can download the app by searching Off-Broad Street in the Apple Store or Android Market. For more information, offbroadstreet.org.
Later today on This American Life, Michael Lewis tells the incredible story of how a teenage boy made it into college, into Harvard no less, thanks to a stolen library book in another language, and real essays and emails sent to college admissions officers, including one from a parent that begins, "My second grader has decided on a career in electrical engineering. He is leaning towards MIT. As schools start, how I got into college, later today.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with all-star pitcher Jamie Moyer and Larry Platt, and they have co-authored a book called Just Tell Me I Can't. It's about Jamie Moyer's long career in baseball and also the influence of a psychologist who helped him with his game. One of the things that this psychologist said to him, the psychologist who's no longer with us, named Harvey Dorfman, said, "I don't care about your feelings, I care about what you do." And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, there is a section in the book, Jamie, about this garter belt that I'm staring at here, which you carry around. Go ahead.
Well,
what's the story?
You know, back in my Baltimore days, and Larry, you can chime in whenever you feel like it. That's back when Bull Durham was a very popular movie. And I was kind of struggling at a particular time, and a friend of mine by the name of Scooter, who I grew up with, thought it'd be kind of cool if he sent me a garter belt and trying to, you know, pass some good wishes on to me. And I don't think he ever thought I was going to wear it.
Because it worked in the movie for Tim Robbins' character.
But being what I call now stupidstitious, I did wear it. And as Larry will tell you, I did win the night that was against the Red Sox. I beat the Red Sox and wore it many times after that, but was embarrassed, you know, to be having this on, and was afraid it was going to be able visible through my uniform. So I would have to go in the bathroom to put it on and take it off.
But it's funny you call that stupidstitious, because I do think a lot of sports players, especially the by themselves, where a pitcher is, or even tennis players as well, they seem to have a lot of superstitious behaviors, mannerisms, ticks, things that they do.
Yeah, and, you know, again, if it works for you and you feel like, you know, it's part of your day, well, then go ahead and use it. But, you know, I mean, again, this was a little over the top, so that's why I call it stupidstitious.
Yeah, but you still carry it around.
I do. You know, it's just, you know, this is my shaving kit that I carry with me for, you know, 20-some years. So, and just opening it up brings back a lot of good memories. You know, I have a number of quirks from when I was with the Seattle Mariners and we clinched, you know, for playoffs and things like that with the Phillies in the World Series. You know, you open it up and it's just, you know, I've got notes on hitters. I've got my my charts that I took from my information that I took from Harvey's book, things that I would do in my pregame preparation. You know, I can pull this stuff out and have vivid memories and take me to really good places. So, you know, to be able to have this, I enjoy sharing it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's great stuff. Larry, you say there's really two Jamie Moyers, and one is the gentleman and one is the warrior.
That's right. He is renowned throughout baseball as a class act. Media goes to him after the game. He always has time for people. He's won the Branch Rickey Award, the Roberto Clemente Award as a humanitarian of the game. But on the mound, like his mentor, Harvey Dorfman, he could be an SOB. and I mean that with affection and respect. Harvey said to him in that first meeting to consider the mound your effing circle. And that has been his clarion call. When we talked earlier about aggression, Harvey got him to see that he had to pitch inside. Mm. And after that first session with Harvey, Jamie wrote in one of these notebooks, "Knock someone down." He's a very old school, very polite, very, as you can tell, very articulate, nice guy. On the mound, he's mean.
Well, and we were talking during the break about something that you would ask batters sometimes, which is, what do you want?
Yeah.
Which seems so counterintuitive.
Right. Well, at time, or I even pregame, if I would, you know, going over a scouting report with a catcher, and I'd say, this guy owns me. You know, I knew who hit me well and who didn't hit me, and it's in the back of the book. There's some guys that, you know, both ways. And I'd say, you know what, we'd go over a scouting report, and I might be a little frustrated, and he'd say, well, I think we should do this. I'm like, you know what, that guy's beat me on that pitch so many times. I'd look at the catcher and say, look, why don't you just tell him what's coming today? And the guy would look at me like, are you kidding me? We can't do that. But really, it's because now, because what I'm trying to do is play with your psyche and try to get you out of kilter a little bit. And if I can regain that edge or get the upper hand on you, now you're going to become frustrated and you're going to start playing outside of your own boundaries and getting in your own way. And that's exactly what I want you to do.
Because the batter would be saying, why are you asking me this question?
Exactly. And usually they're pretty locked in, or term we use, locked in or focused. So if I could get you out of focus and get you thinking or laughing, or, you know, get you relaxed, and all of a sudden I get a ball by you and you go, oh, you got me. You know, that's not going to happen again. So now all of a sudden they think about that at bat, you know, especially when they weren't successful, till they come up again. And now all of a sudden here's where that cat and mouse game goes.
On a good day, when you were pitching well, did everything seem clearer to you?
Most definitely.
I mean, and on those bad days, it just doesn't have that clarity?
You don't have that clarity. You might hear somebody barking at you in the stands. You know, Moyer, you stink. You're an old man. You need to retire. But I got in deeper into my career, I started to use that as a positive tool. Mm. Because when I could hear it, that would tell me that I wasn't focused. And when I didn't hear it, it didn't matter, because I was so focused and so locked in, it didn't matter. So when I would hear it, I would usually call timeout, step off the mound, untie my shoe, retie my shoe, and then refocus.
Anything you want to add to that? I do want to get to our calls. Anything you want to add to that, Larry?
It just reminded me of when Jamie was in spring training with the Colorado Rockies, and Mark Kotze for San Diego came up to bat. Kotze had a career average of .538 against Jamie, and it wasn't spring training. It was the game the game in which you set the record, because Jamie looks in and says, hey, it was April 15th, and he said, hey, it's tax day. You want to declare me on your taxes? And this guy was totally discombobulated and grounded out the shortstop.
I'm going to remember that. So let me reintroduce the two of you. We're talking with all-star pitcher Jamie Moyer, Larry Platt, who's written a lot of books about sports. They have co-authored a new book called Just Tell Me I Can't, How Jamie Moyer Defied the Radar Gun and Defeated Time. And we're talking about his long career as a baseball player in the major leagues, of course, and talking about what he learned from a psychologist, a guy named Harry Dorfman. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Dave from Fairmount joining us. And Dave, go ahead, your radio times.
Thank you. Just a quick question for Jamie, and then an anecdote, if I may, on Jamie's career. Jamie, I remember watching you pitch a complete game shutout, becoming the oldest major leaguer ever to achieve that feat just a few years ago. Do you remember that?
I do vividly remember that. Do you know who had the two hits in that game?
Oh.
Gosh, it was a two-hitter. Oh, I'd forgotten that he'd done so well. No.
Do
you remember who it was against?
I can't. I just remember watching it and thinking to myself, this has to be a rare. Nobody is ever going to compete.
Is this what you do to batters? I'm just asking you, Jamie Moyer.
No, Dave, it was against the Atlanta Braves, and Troy Glaus had both hits, and they were in the six hole at shortstop. Oh. How about that?
That close from a no-hitter. Jamie, just an anecdote, if I may. I had an old baseball coach who once described to me the life of American men existing in three stages. The first stage, when you're younger than all the ball players, and then stage two, when you're the same age as all the major league ball players, and the last stage of life, stage three, when you're older than all the major league ball players. You're just 6 months older than me, Jamie. And so what I want to say to you is thank you for keeping me in stage two for as long as you did.
I love it. Nice. All right, Dave. That was very well put.
Very well put. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And it's funny he said that, because Jamie Morris, I was reading this book. It was like oldest.
Right.
Do you like that?
You know what? You learn to like it because, you know, when I first started to hear it, it was like, really? I'm not that old. But in baseball terms, I was. But in life, in the game of life, you know, I really wasn't. But everybody started to use it because it was easy to use. Hey, old man, you know, and, you know, stuff in the newspaper, on TV, you know, wherever it was. So, I just learned to like it, and actually had a lot of fun with it. And my teammates, once they got to know me, you know, the Jimmy Rollins, the Chase Utleys, those guys, Shane Victorino's, they really like to use it on me. So, but it was fun because I could always, you know, if I got a little tired, I'd say, hey, boys, remember, you need to respect your elders.
And that does work, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
I guess occasionally.
Yep.
What did you learn? And in many ways, as I was reading this book and some of the things that Dorfman was teaching Jamie Meyer could be applied to a lot of life.
Absolutely. What I learned a ton. When Jamie and I first met, I had just had shoulder surgery. We're basically the same age. There was a moment when we were just before he went to spring training. It's a short scene in the book. We're driving down, ironically enough, the Ted Williams Highway in San Diego, and a car is passing us with, I don't know, an 80-year-old woman who's blaring Holiday, the song by Madonna, and singing. And Jamie Moyer sees that in his rearview mirror. He says, check this out. He rolls his windows down. He honks. He calls to her. They both are driving on the highway together, singing together. And I thought, this is what the book is about. It's actually how to age. It's actually how to be youthful and vibrant. He is an object lesson.
Well, as you mentioned, Jamie Moyer, and we're talking about you as if you're not in the room here, but we know that you are, but also pitched during the steroid years. I mean, I don't know if those years are over or not, but that's a tough time to be a baseball player.
Well, it's a tough time, but ironically enough for him, mm-hmm. it was a great time because, as I said earlier, he was able to flourish in that era, and as a fan, he's very disappointed in that, but he profited from it as a player.
You agree with that, Jamie?
I would. You know, and you know, again, we run through all sorts of cycles and stages in life and sports, and you know, you learn as an athlete and I can say it as a parent of eight children. You know, you've at times you have to roll with the punches. You know, you have to know when you can put your foot down, and when is the right time, when's not the right time. And, you know, as a baseball player, I just really, you know, the way I've been raised as a human being, it's been hard work. It's been dedication. My parents were very blue collar, you know, growing up in Souderton. And I like that.
Yeah.
It's a good way. It's a good way to live. And I think it's just a good role to have. And I try to be that, you know, to our children. I try to be that to my teammates. You know, nothing comes easy, and nobody's going to give you anything. You have to earn things in life, and it's something I feel like I've always lived by, and we'll follow forever.
But did you see? I mean, just watching the changing bodies of players, did you see that?
Oh, yeah,
see what seemed to be apparent.
Yeah, but again, I'm not a professional in you know, in assessing that. But you sensed it, you saw it, but you didn't know if guys were legitimately doing it or not. But I know. Also, you know, I knew how difficult it was to, you know, put 10, 15, 20 pounds on in an off season because I was working out too, but I wasn't I wasn't making those gains. So, but, you know, again, technology's come a long way too. You know, everybody now uses strength coaches and things like that. And I tip my hat to those guys that are doing it the right way. But, you know, guys obviously found shortcuts. And, you know, it's come back to haunt a lot of people. So, again, it comes full circle and says, you know what, if you do things the right way and keep your nose to the grindstone, good things can happen.
Did it hurt the game? I mean,
I think it has had an effect on the game.
Or?
But, you know, I think, you know, we live in a society, too, that, you know what, we forgive if you forgive, or we forgive and we forget. And, you know, and I think at times, too, you have to turn the page. I would like to say that we're done with that and we're out of those stages, but every now and then, you know, we'll find somebody that trips and falls with it. But, you know, I think at some point, you know, we're going to come up with a stringent enough penalty. And I think once baseball can do that, it will be gone. It will be behind us. And it would be really nice as an athlete to not have to talk about it and concentrate on it.
Sure. You're nodding your head.
And it'll be a thing of the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been very critical of baseball for the first offense is a 50-game suspension. Well, if the first offense was you're done, there's a zero tolerance, no one would do it if the penalties were that severe, and that's hopefully that's where they'll get to go. and recent events suggest that maybe that's the case.
Well, let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking baseball with former Phillies pitcher Jamie Moyer and with Larry Platt. Let's see what Michael from Broomall has to say. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Jamie, I used to have a Sunday season ticket for the Phillies for many years, and one of my favorite things was to watch you make lifelong baseball fans out of really young kids by spending maybe an hour, maybe more, on days that you weren't starting, walking down the right field line beyond the dugout, signing autographs, and watching these kids turn around with this just incredulous look on their face after actually speaking a few words to you and getting an autographed ball or a hat or whatever. And you could just see it in their face that this was it for them. They, forget football. They were now baseball fans forever. And so few people actually do that in the game. It was very satisfying to watch and made me a lifelong Jamie Moyer fan.
Well, Michael, cool. That's a great call. Go ahead,
thank
Jim.
You. And thank you for those comments. But you know what? I've always remembered as a baseball player, I was a kid, and I really felt that having the opportunity to wear a uniform allowed me to continue to be a kid. And, you know, you try not to remember where, or you try to remember where you came from. And as I went through my career, you know what, being a kid is good, but relating to kids when you can and when you have the time, and, you know, sometimes fans don't understand it, but for the most part they do. That when you have time and you can give them some time down on the field and sign some autographs, shake a hand, just make somebody's day, it may just be a hello. I really learned that that can go a long way, and obviously you just elated to that. So, you know, I thank you for that. But I just feel like as a baseball player and representing the Philadelphia Phillies, and I had that time, I really tried to – when I started to do that, I didn't realize how important it was until I really started to do it. So I really tried to, when I got to the ballpark, put that in my schedule. So at the end of the day, before the game started, and you know, the end of my day, put it that way, before the game started, I tried to leave at least a half an hour to 45 minutes pregame to go out and sign autographs. And believe me, as much as maybe you say that I had impact on somebody else, you know, all those other people had impact on me because those were all pleasant experiences. Giving and taking. And to me, that's what it's about. It's the experience. So, you know, not only was it an experience for a fan, but it was an experience for me.
Now, Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. About a minute before our second break here, Larry. But it is interesting to think about Phillies fans, notorious for their outspokenness, shall we say.
Notorious for their outspokenness, but also notorious for their passion. And I think they recognized in Jamie, first of all, when they won the World Series and he made that speech and he said, you know, in 1980, I sat where you sat. He grew up a Phillies fan, idolizing Steve Carlton. So that's part of the affection that this town has for someone like him.
In fact, didn't you play hooky that day, or you got out of school that day so you could come down?
I can now say it. I did play hooky.
couldn't have gotten away with that if you had somehow admitted it in high school.
Right, exactly.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Jamie Moyer, he is an all-star pitcher, or can I say was an all-star pitcher for the Seattle Mariners?
Was,
member of the 2008 World Series Phillies. He's the president of the Jamie Moyer Foundation, which serves the needs of kids in distress. Also with us is Larry Platt, co-author with Jamie Moyer of a book called Just Tell Me I Can't. And Larry Platt, former editor of the Philadelphia Daily News and Philadelphia Magazine, and he's written a number of books about sports figures, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Fringe Art supports WHYY and presents the 2013 Fringe Festival now through September 22nd, featuring over 150 local and international theater, dance, music, and visual art events in venues across Philadelphia. Spotlight shows include Where We Live by So Percussion, a multi-sensory concert that coaxes music from the work of guest artisans like a violin maker, a metal worker, and a brewmaster who join musicians, dance, theater, and video artists on stage. Tickets at fringearts.com.
On the next Fresh Air, on the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, we talk about national security and surveillance with Bart Gellman, one of three journalists who received classified documents from NSA leaker Edward Snowden in June. Gellman has reported on those documents in the Washington Post. He wrote the bestseller Angler about the Cheney vice presidency. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
From the rubble and the ruins, the horror and the heartache, emerges a tower of 104 stories standing at 1,776 feet.
Resiliency. We've triumphed. We've come back. We've built this. We're reaching for the stars.
The legacy of the Freedom Tower on the anniversary of 9/11, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Jamie Moyer is known for his slow pitches and his longevity in baseball. Last year, at the age of 49, he became the oldest major league pitcher to win a game. He's a hero here in the city of brotherly love for being part of the 2008 team that won the World Series after something like a 28-year drought. And he joins us along with Larry Platt, who has written a book with Moyer titled Just Tell Me I Can't, How Jamie Moyer Defied the Radar Gun and Defeated Time. And it's amazing. Anyways, about Jamie Moyer's career, but it's also about this foul-mouthed psychologist who had a lot of advice about how to play the game and how to win the game and how to take care of one's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You have these notebooks and these notes and things that are sitting there right in front of you, Jamie.
Yeah, Moyer. I have. I kept a notebook. I actually had numerous notebooks since I played so long, but on hitters. And Larry thought it'd be a good idea if I brought one in. And
sure.
And read you know, some notes. I opened to a page here. I have Conine. That would be Jeff Conine. He's a right-handed hitter. I have a little side note. He will run. These are my little notes that I had for him. He's a first-ball fastball hitter. His power is down and in. He dives hard on me, which means he's diving out over the plate because he's figured out. He was a good hitter. Sinkers, backdoor breaking balls. Hard at his belt, so I throw him fastballs at his belt and changeups. So, just little things like that. So that was my, so if I was going over a lineup and he was in the lineup, that would be how I would start my day with Jeff Conine. Now, I may look at some video. I may talk to my catchers. I may have watched him during the course of the series and maybe have, saw something a little different, something like that. But that's what I would do with that. Now, also, throughout the, Harvey's book, The Mental Guide to Baseball, yep, some things I picked up. And these are things that I would go over pregame for myself. There were some questions I would ask myself. After making a mistake, to make an adjustment, number one, I would ask myself, what was I trying to do? Number two, I'd say, what went wrong? And number three, what do I have to do next time? So,
very positive questions, right?
Right.
Not then, why the heck did I do
right,
this, right?
Right. And then three questions that I had with problem solving is awareness, realizing there is a problem or to define the problem. Number two would be forming a strategy, what has to be done. And number three, act it out or just plain do it.
Just do it.
So, yeah. And
I've
then
heard that before,
some other things that I would read real quickly here, I'd say visualization, but not night before the game. Then I'd ask myself, consistent preparation, regular pattern, irregular pattern. Did I trust my talent? Level of concentration and focus, always, often, usually, rarely, or never. Good tempo, pace of work, sluggish or steady. How did I adjust in tough situations? Step off the rubber, step off the mound. Hmm. Posture, body language, aggressive, strong versus sluggish. Now, I could also use that for my eyes, too. Or facial expression, strong eyes versus weak eyes. Positive functional thoughts, always, often, usually, rarely, never. Tell yourself what to do one pitch at a time. Good behavior on the rubber, selection and location. meaning next pitch only, always, often, usually, rarely, or never. And then relaxation by exhaling. Breathing pattern, deep exhale before every pitch.
But it sounds like it's staying in the present, right?
Yes.
I mean, don't
yes.
beat yourself up. If it's a bad pitch, you don't. You just you have to be in the present for the next one.
Exactly. And then I had a concentration grid that was 0-0 to 99 that would really take up, you know, some of my time. But it's really trying to narrow my focus. So that was the last thing that I would do. These questions are things that self-check things that I could ask myself pre-game, during the game, and post-game.
I mean, it's interesting to think about these rituals, Larry.
It was a real pattern designed to get him to optimal performance level by the time the umpire said play ball. And the other thing that's just fascinating, so Jamie is the all-time leader in giving up home runs,
yes,
522. And one of the things he had to learn is that that's okay. Not only is it okay, he came to the realization that sometimes that is a positive, or I think the phrase is giving up a home run can be a rally killer, because he'll walk off the mound, he'll put his glove out, like, give me that damn ball back, that's it, you're done. And he'd give up a solo home run, but not the five run inning. So that realization freed him up in a way.
Do you think there were so many home runs off your pitching because it was slow? I mean, for the
slow
kind of
mistakes. I had a lot of opportunities. You know, pitching 20-some years, I had far more opportunities than most. So it's going to catch up to you. But, yeah, you know, being of the slower type of pitching, you know, even if I made sometimes a good pitch, you know, guys are big enough and strong enough to hit the ball out of the ballpark. So, I mean, there's a combination of many things. You know, and I'm not going to make any excuses. I threw them. So I was the culprit, you know, that threw them. So, and I had to live and die with, you know, how good or how bad. But I got away with just as many bad pitches as I didn't get away with good pitches. So, you know, that's baseball.
One of the things that's in this book is that the hardest thing in baseball is hitting a baseball, is being the batter trying to hit a baseball.
I think there seems to be general accord that it's the hardest thing in all sports.
In all sports.
Because, you know, there's a 2-inch sweet spot on that cylindrical bat, and you're trying to hit this ball going anywhere from, you know, 90 miles. You have literally a split second to make a decision. And that's why, as Jamie always points out, it's really a game about failure. The best hitters fail 70% of the time.
Were you a good hitter?
No. In high school, I was a decent hitter, but I would never say I was a great hitter. I was a pesky hitter.
What's a pesky hitter?
Oh, I'd foul balls off, and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Drive the pitcher crazy,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. I'd make you work. Yeah,
but you do own a hitting record.
I do, actually. I'm the oldest to have an RBI in Major League Baseball history. So,
yay!
You know, again, longevity. You know, when you have longevity, crazy things like that can happen.
And what explains your longevity? I mean, is it just your style of pitching?
Well, I think there's a lot. Again, it's a combination of many things. It starts with health. You know, good genes. You know, I've been blessed by my parents to have good genes. Work ethic. I really probably didn't have my first surgery in my career till I was in my mid to late 40s.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate that way. I've been, you know, I was pretty healthy throughout my career. Good people around me. I learned, you know, I really felt like I had to be a sponge, because I didn't feel like when I came into this game, I had, you know, unbelievable talent. I just felt like I had talent and I was good at what I did. You know, and hence, just tell me I can't, because that's really what I was told my whole life. You're too small. You don't throw hard enough. I was always told the things that I couldn't do, but from my side of it, my perspective, I always had success. So why am I going to let these people deter me from a dream of mine? And that's really, you know, as I, you know, got hanging out with Harvey, that's when it really kind of hit home. Like, yeah, you know what? You're right, Harv. I can do this. You know, and then, you know, he got me to believe.
Yeah.
And obviously, I had to make some adjustments too. And it just snowballed in a positive direction for me.
I mean, it sounded like he was that sort of tough love model.
Oh yeah. You know what? And you know, I can, I can sit here and think back to conversations. I can put myself in the situation that I was at his home, visiting his home, and when we were talking, like it just happened. Mm. I can put myself in phone conversations that he and I had, because he had kind of that raspy voice. And you just, when he spoke, you listened.
He worked with other players as well, right, Larry?
He did, and a number of Jamie's teammates, Roy Halladay, Brad Lidge, Kyle Kendrick, various. But he also was, we talked about how tough Jamie is. So, you know, Bonds went to him, but Bonds was supposed to show up at 2. He showed up at 4, and Harvey said, lose my number.
That's it.
And wouldn't deal with
strike.
Him. Wouldn't deal with him. No nonsense guy who had a knack for motivating these macho athletes.
You know, sometimes you look at pitchers pitching or even just the slow motion and you wonder why they haven't blown their mm-hmm. arm out of their socket. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think of Jamie Moyer not having a surgery until later in your career.
Mm-hmm. Well, and his surgeon who performed the Tommy John surgery called him a freak of nature. He said people don't heal like this. And one of the reasons, we talked about this a little bit last night, is I think he, in the off season since 1990, would work out as if he were injured, even though he wasn't, right?
Mm-hmm. I called it prehab. It was my first injury that I had in my career and had to go on the disabled list and wasn't probably 100% healthy at the end of the season. So I figured I needed to go back to a physical therapist and then used that physical therapist throughout the off season and went to spring training the next year and thought, oh my gosh, I feel like I have a brand new arm. I feel like I've never pitched before. And I like this feeling. So, and I know how the season really runs you down, or I knew how it really runs you down as a player. So I made a vow to myself that every off season after that I would go to a physical therapist, and mm-hmm. I did. And I think that was one of my little secrets, and not really a secret. I would talk about it candidly with anybody. But anybody who now inquires or asks, well, give me some ways that, why you were so healthy. That would be a huge one. And in the way, when I'm talking to players, it's like, this is an investment. You're investing in your own career. So why wouldn't you do this? There's no guarantees. And just like there's in life, there's no guarantees with anything. But if I could give myself a better chance to stay healthy, I'm doing it.
Did you know when you started playing with the 2008 Phillies started playing that this was a really good team?
Yeah, I realized it was a really good team. That I realized that, we could get to a World Series. Probably not initially, but I think what really helped that team in 2008 was the failure in 2007. We made it to the playoffs, and the Colorado Rockies cut through us like butter, if you recall. They swept us in a 3-game series. Yep. It was demoralizing. It was embarrassing. And I really sensed that in spring training of 2008, guys came back with a sense of urgency to spring training. There was a different feel in that clubhouse from the first day we were all together. And it just kind of carried, and it snowballed in a good direction. And we believed, and we had a bunch of people that wanted to work and wanted to be there and cared and got along. And, good things started to happen. And like you say, it's a long season. You're going to have ups and downs. But you really felt as the season progressed that, hey, this has a chance to be a special group of guys, and it was.
Well, and it's always fun as a fan or even a sporadic fan, which mm-hmm. I would include mm-hmm. myself in mm-hmm. that, is that when there's the possibility of a World Series, people get excited. I mean, you can just sense it, Larry, as you take the subway or walk around the streets.
Oh, and it lifts the entire psyche of the city. I mean, it changes everyone's day for a long time. I mean, this was not, yes, we won the World Series in 2008, but this was like a 5-year reign of excellence in this town that the Phillies produced that was probably the best 5 years in the history of the franchise.
Well, and we lived in the city. We saw it every day.
Yeah.
Get up in the morning and go down and, you see people walking up and everybody had red on and people were, and then people that would recognize, hey, let's go. Yeah, you guys are going to win. And there was a genuine excitement and it was fun. It was really fun to live that and be a part of it.
Do you ever think of coaching? Is that something that's on
your radar? It's something that I would consider. I don't know when that right time is, if it's next year, if it's 2 years, if it's 5 years, whenever it may be. But it's, you know, we've got young kids at home. I do want to be a part of their lives. I've missed a lot of our older kids' lives because of baseball. And again, I'm not complaining. It's a fact.
Yep.
And that's part of it. I'm going to start a pitching academy as well, the Moyer Pitching Academy, and really try to spend time with people, the people who come, kids who come, on the mental side of the game. I think it's really important. I think it's a part of the game that's really overlooked. And then obviously the mechanical side of it and taking care of yourself. I think that's another important part of the game. And, you know, when you're playing at the major league level, 162 games a year plus 30 spring training games, 200 games a year approximately, it's a long, grueling season.
Yeah.
So you've got to be prepared mentally and physically.
And the Jamie Moyer Foundation?
Moyer Foundation is running strong. We have grief camps, 41 grief camps for children ages 6 to 17, free grief camps called Camp Aaron. We have another camp called Camp Mariposa for children affected by who live under the roof of an addicted family member. We have every other month we have a camp. We have five of those camps throughout the United States at this point. That's called Camp Mariposa. Anybody that would like to learn more about the Moyer Foundation can go to moyerfoundation.org. Learn about who we are, where we are, where we're going. We actually have an annual giving luncheon. It's actually the first annual giving luncheon, September 19th here in Philadelphia. So we're really excited about that. Cole Hamels will be honored at that luncheon as well. So, a lot of exciting things going on with us and our foundation. And, it's a great way to be able to give back and make a difference in children's living in distress.
And you feel, we're almost out of time here, but a special connection to children in distress?
Well, we do. You ask why or how, it just kind of came about. And, the way we look at it, these kids don't ask to be in the situations that they're in. And if we can kind of be a voice for them or stand on a platform and talk about situations that are important to us, and that's childhood grief or drug abuse, drug and alcohol abuse with children who really don't have a leg to stand on, if we can be that sounding board or those people for some of those issues, we can bring more awareness to that, not only in this community, but in communities around the country, and hopefully get more people involved. And the more people we can get involved and hold hands, and we can make a bigger difference. And we're proving that.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Jamie Moyer. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, and Larry Platt as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And they have co-authored a book called Just Tell Me I Can't, How Jamie Moyer Defied the Radar Gun and Defeated Time. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.